Hill.
And have a good weekend.
Yeah, stay frosty, everybody.
Good evening. It's 5 p.m. on Thursday, March 12th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we visit a portrait exhibit at the Tech Gallery, challenging the stigma around homelessness, sharing the stories of Kingston residents who have experienced housing insecurity and found support through Lionhearts. A Kingston-born photographer shares a national milestone with his work now traveling across the country, and some news out of City Hall this week, including updates from Council's last meeting, a joint statement from the mayors of Kingston and South Frontenac and Safe South Frontenac on the Alto Rail Project, and the start of another University District Safety Initiative period leading up to St. Patrick's Day next week. Without further delay, let's dive in. This week, an exhibit on display at the Tet Center is highlighting the stories of people in Kingston who have faced homelessness and who have found support through Lionhearts. The exhibit, entitled A Sheltered Life, features portraits of 10 individuals who have experienced housing insecurity, with their redemptive stories displayed alongside the work. The project includes work by artists Sherry Dosager, Ben Spadzinski, and Kyla Todd, and also serves as a fundraiser supporting Lionheart's transitional housing initiatives. At present, 34 persons have been placed into safe, affordable homes through Lionhearts. Still, as of early 2026, more than 570 people in Kingston are experiencing homelessness. Through this exhibit, the artists hope to bring attention to the human stories behind those numbers. I joined artist Kyla Todd at the Tet Gallery this week, and she shared how the project first came together.
Well, it started, I would say, like over a year ago. I was chatting with my friend Al Dosager, and I said to him, I have this idea of drawing, painting portraits and telling stories. And he was like, that's a great idea. And I said, but, you know, I can't do it myself. Like, I don't have a connection with anyone, really. But he did. Like, he works at Lionhearts. And so we decided to work together. And he, because he's sort of like on the ground, you know, like chatting with people. He's somebody that people trust really well. And so he was like, okay, this is a good idea. I'm going to make it happen. It started off slowly. Like, I didn't hear anything for like a few months. And then one day, Al and I, we went and we chatted with some people at the line. It was actually at the shelter that was on Adelaide at the time. And that was, I think, maybe in the summer. And then in September, it was myself, Al, and Sherry, who's the other artist. We all got together and we started chatting. And so from there, it was like Al's job to figure out, okay, who first of all, people have to be willing to tell their stories, right? So whose stories are we going to tell? And then once we started to figure out whose stories we're going to tell, it was like Sherry and I wanted to meet them. So, and the only person that I painted that I didn't get to meet was Andrew, or Andy, but everyone else, like I went down and Ben, our photographer, took a lot of the really awesome, you know, photos, but the ones that I painted from, most of them, except for Andrew, like I took just because I was there meeting with them. We figured out, so I would have figured out who I was painting at least maybe about by December is when my first painting was Justin, so I started painting him, and then basically I spent like the month of January and February, like that's all I did was paint.
Todd says the project was always about more than creating portraits. The artists wanted the work to help people connect with the stories behind each face.
What I wanted, like, and why I wanted to be art is because, you know, like art is it connects you with people, right? You look at an art piece and you feel something in your heart for whatever reason. And even when you're painting, like creating a piece of art is like, it's like a part of you. Do you know what I mean? So the whole purpose of this was to show really that we're all connected. You know what I mean? Like we're all humans. These people are in a situation but we're connected with them. And the idea was to hopefully make us realize that really this could happen to anyone. Like, we're all like a tragedy or two or like a few really bad months away from being in this situation ourselves. And so creating art is like a way of breaking down a barrier, I felt.
Every portrait was created with that connection in mind, placing each person in a setting that reflected part of their personal story.
Well, definitely when we were doing the portraits, we wanted there to be context. Because for one thing, when it's just a painting of, say, a face, and you don't necessarily know the person, you may not feel as connected to just a face. But if you see somebody sitting on bleachers, for example, and you can imagine being there with them. So, like, doing the portraits in a context was important, to show a bit about who they are. Who they are and their situations. So Andy's on the bleachers because that's where he lived for a good chunk of time, like under the bleachers. So when they found him, when they were able to talk to him, that's where they talked to him, on the bleachers, because that's where he was living for a good chunk of time. And Kenny right here, this is the painting with a mop in the bucket. So we painted him in this long hallway because that's the hallway of the shelter. So if you read his story, you'll realize that he has been working at the shelter. But just showing him in this context was important to us, mm-hmm. You know, and Phyllis knitting. So for me, like, Phyllis is the one that her story breaks my heart. Well, they all are heartbreaking, but just to know that she's in a safe place right now and knitting, that it's really important.
Since the opening show last weekend, Todd says the exhibit has drawn strong reactions from visitors, many of whom have been deeply moved by the stories being shared.
There's quite a lot of people here, and people were moved by the stories, and we had some people who were crying, you know, because it's really sad, some of the situations. And people were very happy that that we've done this. And I was talking to a woman from City Hall, and she wants to take the whole thing down to City Hall. It's a possibility. And people were just overall very supportive of the project. And I think a lot of people resonated with sort of our intentions. Certain people resonated with certain people's stories, right? Like, so some people would come up to me and say, like, oh my gosh, like, Phyllis's story. And I was like, I know. You know, so people saying that they really loved the stories. They loved how they were written. They loved how, it was Al who wrote the stories, and it just felt like somebody was just speaking. Do you know what I mean? Like, it didn't feel formal. It just felt like a person telling the story in a really meaningful way.
For Todd, the goal of the project is ultimately connection, helping people recognize the humanity they share with those whose lives have taken very different paths.
I hope that they walk away feeling a greater sense of their connection to other humans. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're all in this together, and we are here, I don't know, we're here for each other. Like, this idea that we are separate from each other, like, I want us to be able to understand this, like, shared humanity that we have.
A Sheltered Life will be on display in the Tech Gallery until Friday, March 13th. Kingston-born photographer Brett Hitchens is seeing his work travel across the country, one letter at a time. Canada Post has selected Hitchens' photography for its 2026 annual Flower Series commemorative stamps, featuring cherry blossoms photographed at Vancouver's Natobe Memorial Garden. While Hitchens now lives and works on the West Coast, he grew up on a family farm just outside of Kingston, a connection to the landscape he says continues to shape how he sees and photographs the world. I spoke with Brett about his Kingston roots and what it means to have his work featured on a stamp collection that will circulate nationwide. To start us off, you grew up in the Kingston region. How did that landscape kind of shape your eye as a photographer?
Yeah, definitely. I grew up on a family farm just outside of Kingston, kind of in the West End. And my grandparents' family is from Amherst Island. I feel like as a kid out in the country, you're just kind of like always out in the yard, on the farm, exploring, kind of like in the forest and the trails and stuff. And I feel like, yeah, just as a person, a photographer, especially moving to a big city, it's like you kind of don't realize how special that is to just be able to go kind of like explore and roam in the landscape. So yeah.
And when you heard your photos were going to be part of the 2026 flower series, what was your first initial reaction?
Yeah, really exciting. The project kind of started 2 years ago. And so it's been like a long process. And so we've known for a little bit that it's come out. And yeah, to kind of finally be released to the public is really special. I think it's an honor that not many photographers ever get the opportunity to have their work focused, kind of to ever get their work featured on a stamp. And so yeah, just it feels really special.
Yeah, and you kind of got into it there, but what does it mean for you to have your work featured on this national series, and to know that it's traveling across the country?
Honestly, like I said, I think it's really special. A lot of friends and family have been reaching out and sharing congratulations, and it's something that'll kind of live forever, which is really nice to kind of be able to look back on in several years from now, hopefully, and just kind of remember, it's kind of accomplishment. But yeah, it's just it's nice to kind of share it amongst everybody.
Awesome. And your stamp features cherry blossoms. I was wondering what drew you to photographing these blooms in particular.
Yeah, I photograph a lot for the Bandusen Botanical Gardens, and so that's kind of how I got connected on the collaboration for the assignment. We were I worked with John Belisle, who is the graphic designer, and we got partnered with the Natobi Botanical Garden at UBC, which is a Japanese botanical gardens, and they feature a lot of common and rare cherry trees. So yeah, the directive was from Canada Post to capture cherry blossoms, and so that was kind of part of the assignment. But just as a whole, like I love capturing kind of like home and gardens and public landscapes, botanical gardens, and cherry trees. They're just so kind of fleeting, beautiful, and their blossoms are just like really a unique, exciting thing to capture in photography.
And even though you're based in Vancouver now, do you still see connections between your work and your Kingston roots?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, I think I kind of grew up in kind of playing around on like family farm and in the landscape. So as much as I've been out in Vancouver for several years now, I still have strong family connections back in Kingston. I love kind of coming back every year and just exploring the area again, and especially going to Amherst Island. I find that landscape over there is just like really inspiring. But like rural agricultural Ontario, but like really quiet, really peaceful. And I think that kind of stillness is something that I reflect back on and kind of bring to my work today.
That was Kingston-born photographer Brett Hitchens, whose images are featured in Canada Post's 2026 annual Flower Series stamps. The new stamps are now available through Canada Post. Before we get into more local news this evening, I'm going to turn to your weather and traffic report featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, March 12th, daytime high of 1 degree, overnight low of minus 7. Friday, March 13th, that's right, Friday the 13th, a scary little bit of snow in the forecast. Not too much accumulation, but you hate to see it all the same. Going to feel closer to minus 4, even though the daytime high is listed at 2. Saturday, March 14th, right around 0 for your daytime high, feeling closer to minus 6. Sunday, March 15th, high of 3 degrees, but afternoon snow in the forecast, feeling closer to minus 4. And then starting off next week, Monday, March 16th, Daytime high of 3, feeling closer to -4 with an overnight low of -12. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. As a reminder, overnight street parking restrictions have been eased as of March 1st. This means that overnight street parking is only banned when the weather conditions require it. In terms of road closures for the week, Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is closed indefinitely to accommodate construction activity and staging in the area. The other major road closure for this week is Berry Street to Queen, which is closed indefinitely for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. That's it. That's all I have for you this week. This is Jesse Bell signing off and wishing you all safe travels.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. It's a moment many Kingston residents have experienced more than once this winter. The snowplow finally clears your street and leaves a heavy ridge of snow across the end of your driveway. Councillor Ryan Bohm spoke to this issue in a motion he brought forward at Tuesday's City Council meeting.
We know that, you know, that the defeat you feel when you're done shoveling your driveway, especially after the winter we've just had, and that snowplow comes around the corner and you're like, yay, the snowplow. And then he goes by your driveway and leaves these massive chunks that you have no hope of clearing. And you're kind of like, yay, the snowplow.
Windrows created through municipal snowplowing operations are not only a nuisance, but can also present accessibility and service challenges for residents, particularly seniors, persons with disabilities, and households with limited capacity to remove heavy or compacted snow. Several other Ontario municipalities have implemented driveway windrow clearing programs using specialized equipment with a range of service models, eligibility criteria, and funding approaches. Bohm's motion, which received unanimous support from council, will have the city examine the possibility of implementing a similar driveway windrow clearing service in Kingston.
This is more just to explore what's the actual cost of having what other municipalities have, that extra little arm that comes down and essentially just pushes that, right? So it would push it into a bank. The technology exists, other places around us do it, but we don't really understand what it would cost, how it would be implemented, and we're just lacking information. So realistically, this starts that conversation. It's going to give us the information, and then we'll be able to make better informed decisions going forward. I'm kind of in favor of it. I'd love to see this report come back. And realistically, we know that, you know, there's people with disabilities and accessibility issues. We know we have a large senior population. So, I mean, there's a lot of the community that's been asking for this quite some time. And when I started digging into it, realized there was a massive information gap on what the costs would actually be and how we could implement this. So that's basically what we're looking to have that conversation and get some better information on this.
Councillors around the horseshoe were supportive, citing what they've heard from their constituents on the issue over the years.
I have received a number of complaints from constituents who are predominantly senior citizens and concerns about accessibility. And so having seen this service been provided in other municipalities, I was more than happy to second the motion.
And I've also had some seniors like come in and approach me and contact me about, you know, it's like I've had to pay somebody 3 times today just to clear my driveway because the plow went by 3 times. And then, you know, and then it's like that the next day and then the next day. And then it ends up being where it's, you know, it's not an affordable thing to sustain. And I just think that this is really worth exploring because I think this is something that would really, the quality of life for the residents would be drastically improved, especially during the winter months and especially with the winter like we just had, so.
A lot of constituents in my district, they asked during the campaign and after the campaign why we cannot do this when other municipalities are doing. And I think it's very important when you wake up 6 o'clock in the morning, you want to go to work, and you just clean your driveway. And after 10 minutes, you went to get shower, change the clothes, you came back, and then it's like a 2 feet, 3 feet high again, the snow in your driveway. And sometime you early evening or late evening, you clean your driveway. In the morning, you came back and you see the pile up snow again, which is also frozen. And then you have to just do it, and it's take your time, and you are late from work, especially for the senior population in our city. It's very difficult, and I think it is a good idea to look into the information, and if we can implement, and that would be great for the people living in this country. It's a great service to provide them.
City staff will now prepare a report examining clearing service models and their applicability to Kingston. The report, expected by the end of the third quarter of 2026, will include a review of programs in comparable municipalities, along with an assessment of potential service delivery options for Kingston, including associated costs, operational implications, benefits, limitations, funding considerations, and impacts on the city's ability to meet minimum maintenance standards. Following on the heels of a motion discussing snow clearing, Councillor Connie Glenn brought forward another weather-related motion, this time focused on preparing for extreme heat.
So I know it seems a little extreme, we're going from snow to heat, but here we are, Canadian to the core.
Councillor Glenn introduced a motion directing staff to report back to council on options for a residential air conditioning unit program aimed at supporting vulnerable residents with medical conditions in the city of Kingston. Staff will review best practices from cities such as Toronto and Hamilton, which have run programs providing free portable air conditioners to low-income residents with health-related conditions in the past. They will also consult with Southeast Public Health, which could help determine eligibility and manage funding distribution for residents to receive units. Glenn made the case for the motion, stressing the importance of preparation as summer temperatures continue to rise.
The reason for bringing this forward, I think we've made some significant steps forward in terms of providing cooling. However, we're still faced with individuals who suffer extreme circumstances in the heat. In 2018, a heat wave sent 13 people to the hospital. And this is something that we're likely to see continue if we don't provide help to those who cannot help themselves in this instance. So the motion is directed very specifically for people who cannot afford their own air conditioning units, for people who are challenged with medical conditions. Now what we're basically saying is, let's have staff and let's have public health go away and come back to us with a solid recommendation that would support the people most in need. So also coming out of our climate change adaptation plan, I note that there was mention of the vast increase in the number of days of 30 plus temperatures, and that this is a general upward trajectory. So this is not an issue that is going away. I want to note a couple of other things there too. July of 2024 was the warmest month on record so far. That wasn't that long ago. So we're not seeing a change in this overall pattern, and we know that it's only going to continue to get worse at the rate that we're seeing the change happen.
Heat response has been an ongoing conversation in council chambers. In winter 2025, council approved a motion establishing a maximum indoor temperature of 26 degrees Celsius for residential units equipped with air conditioning during the summer. However, that motion was not extended to units without air conditioning already installed, due to pushback from property owners and concerns about the legality of such a requirement. While landlords in Ontario are required to provide heating, there is currently no similar obligation for cooling.
One of the things I do want to say, because this was brought up, this is not asking landlords to provide this. We understand the challenges with trying to mandate that. We're not about to turn around and do that at this point. This is just saying, for people who cannot do this for themselves, who are suffering from medical health conditions, let's put some sort of a solid program in place and support them, because really at the end of the day, what it's going to lead to is increased disability, increased numbers of people showing up at our ERs, and really this just speaks to the general well-being of our community, which I hope we're all concerned about.
The motion carried unanimously. Staff are expected to return to council with options by the end of April. A quick turnaround aimed at having a program in place for summer 2026. In a message from the City of Kingston this week, Kingston's own mayor and neighboring municipal leaders are calling on the federal government to route the proposed Alto high-speed rail project along the Highway 401 corridor and to include a stop in Kingston. In a joint statement released this week, the mayors of Kingston and South Frontenac, along with the group Save South Frontenac, say those two changes are essential if the multi-billion dollar project moves forward. They argue that aligning the rail line with the existing Highway 401 transportation corridor would reduce impacts on farmland, wetlands, and rural communities. A Kingston station, they say, would connect the region's major healthcare, education, and economic centers to fast rail service between Toronto, Ottawa, and Montreal. The statement also points to strong local opposition to the current proposed southern route and calls on the federal government to consider public feedback as planning continues. In a second message from the City of Kingston this week, with St. Patrick's Day celebrations approaching, the City of Kingston is reminding residents to celebrate responsibly. The University District Safety Initiative will be in effect starting tomorrow, March 13th through to March 18th, bringing increased bylaw and police presence to the university district. City officials say the initiative aims to prevent large nuisance parties and keep streets clear for emergency vehicles during the busy weekend. Under the city's nuisance party bylaw, hosts of disruptive gatherings could face penalties up to $2,000, while other offenses, including noise violations or refusing to leave a property, may also result in fines. Temporary parking restrictions will also be in place overnight on parts of Division, William, and Earl, with vehicles parked in restricted areas subject to towing. To learn more before celebrations kick off this weekend, you can head to the University District Safety Initiative page on the City of Kingston website. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by local musician Nolan Hubbard and his teammate Cassidy Taylor called Birdie. Inspired by shared experiences of disconnection and isolation, the pair co-wrote the song virtually before coming together to record in person at Cassidy's home in Milton, Ontario, with Nolan traveling from Kingston. Produced and mixed by Nolan and mastered by Yanni Caldres, Birdie invites listeners into a space of heartbreak and healing. Cassidy's vocals float effortlessly over Nolan's signature lush guitar hooks, blending their distinct artistic voices into a story that feels deeply relatable. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via Visit Kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Birdie by Nolan Hubbard and Cassidy Taylor on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Just fly high. comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. This is Adam, joined by a very special guest today. I am with Tara Tamang, my lovely girlfriend. She's decided to fill in for Sam and Kyle today as they're both busy. So she's going to give her insight on all the trades that happened in the NHL over the last few days.
Yeah, no.
She has great insight. Tara's one of the biggest hockey fans I know.
Okay.
It's nice to have you on the show, Tara. I know you've been on like momentarily a couple times, but this is your show. This is the one for you. You get to shine.
So
I'm gonna let you introduce yourself in just a bit. We are going to run through the trade deadline quickly because we promised that we would do it last week. For those of you that weren't paying attention to the NHL over the past week, the NHL trade deadline was last Friday, and it was very uneventful. There was a lot of rumors going in about these major trades that were going to happen, and nothing really came to fruition. I would say the biggest trade the night before the trade deadline was actually John Carlson to the Anaheim Ducks. It's a player that's played all 15-plus seasons with the Washington Capitals, and he got traded to Anaheim. So it'll be his first new team in about 15 years. Alex Ovechkin, his long-term teammate, said it was the saddest day of his life seeing John get traded. So that leaves a lot of discussion as to maybe Alex Ovechkin's future as a Washington Capital. But we won't be able to see that until the end of this year. He's an unrestricted free agent going into the offseason, with many thinking he'll retire. Some other good storylines: Nick Foligno is reunited with his brother Marcus Foligno in Minnesota. Chicago traded Nick for some future considerations. A little bit of a feel-good moment there. Corey Perry's returning to the Tampa Bay Lightning. So another Stanley Cup Finals loss incoming for the Tampa Bay Lightning. Tara, Corey Perry has notoriously been on the losing side of the Stanley Cup Finals. Like, I think he was like 4 or 5 years in a row. He was on Dallas, Tampa Bay, or Dallas, Montreal, Colorado, Tampa Bay, Edmonton. And then that was it. And then this year he switched around teams, but now he's back on Tampa Bay. So it's almost like a curse that he might actually be bad for the team. Like, he gets you to the finals, but he loses, you know?
Ouch.
Yeah,
oh,
no.
Poor
so,
kid.
Oh, he's no kid. He's an old guy. He's an unk, as the kids say.
You can still be a poor kid at any age, I think.
I don't feel too bad for him.
Okay. He makes lots of money.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's okay.
He's known around the league as a bit of a pest, so he's more of a character guy, I guess. They want some ferocity in the dressing room. Some other major trades: the Islanders acquired Braden Schenn for Jonathan Drouin and a couple picks. Bobby McMahon got moved by the Maple Leafs. I know that was not one that a lot of people thought would happen. The Leafs were supposed to be sellers at this trade deadline with how low they are in the standings this year. First time in a long time that the Leafs were sellers. They really didn't do much, shipping away McMahon and Scott Laughton. Scott Laughton went to the Kings, and he had a pretty good start. And then the major trade actually came an hour after the trade deadline. It finally got confirmed, and that was Nazem Kadri is returning to the Colorado Avalanche. The Calgary Flames got Victor Olofsson, Max Kurin, and a first and second round pick for Kadri. So Kadri strengthens an already fantastic Colorado Avalanche team. who really looks like they're going to run away with it, at least in the regular season. We'll see what it looks like in the playoffs, but they are the league leader right now with just 97 points, I believe. So they are running away with it, 95 points. Okay, Tara.
Yeah.
You've had quite the illustrious athletic career. I've always known you as the superhuman athlete from all the intramurals that we've played together.
Oh my gosh, give it a break.
I mean, you guys really, I wish you could see some of these games because she just has this ability to take over and dominate the games.
That is so, okay, this is all lies. You are being fed misinformation.
Let me
set the record straight.
What was the first sport that you ever played growing up? Because I know a lot of kids get into sports really early. Were you one of those
kids? Definitely, yeah. Definitely. I don't remember. I think, does swimming count? Like when you're a baby?
Of course.
And you're a baby
counts.
And you're in the pool with your mom and your dad and they're like teaching you how to hold your breath underwater. I did that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so. Would you tell Michael Phelps that swimming doesn't count?
No, but I wasn't doing it competitively. I was like taking swimming lessons to not drown if I somehow managed to be in water. So that I would say was the first actually thing that I ever did. And then I can't even remember where I started or how it went, but I was notorious as a kid growing up to play like a new sport every single season. There were very few sports, frankly, very few extracurricular activities I did in general that I kind of stuck with until I got a lot older. So I pretty much played every single sport you can think of, except for like the really niche ones.
Like soccer.
Well, I was going to get to that, but I was, I'm half Italian. My mom's Italian and she had like soccer cleats and shin pads waiting for me and my brother in our basement, like all of our young youth life, and we never wanted to play soccer. That was the one sport I never played. I was never in like a Timbits League soccer because like my mom would ask us like, what do you want to do? Like, do you want to play soccer? And I was like, no, I want to do equestrian horseback riding. And she was like, okay,
yeah,
great, sounds good. So never did soccer, funny enough. Don't regret it. I did a lot of other sports to keep me occupied, so I'm not worried.
Now, you've got a twin brother.
I do.
Were you ever playing sports on the same team as your twin, or were you kind of separated? Was it not really like you guys were on the same team? Were you doing different activities, or would you say it kind of lined up, especially earlier on?
Earlier on, we definitely played on the same teams because that's when you're young and, like, you know, doesn't really matter. And you're kind of doing whatever, and you're kind of honestly just learning the sport in general. I remember we were in skating lessons together. You know, specifically figure skating lessons, and then I did ringette. I don't even know. I don't think he even did hockey. I think he went straight into gymnastics. My brother, funny enough, he was a national level gymnast for Canada and, you know, did all this stuff, broke his neck. He's fine now, don't worry, but, you know, very intense athlete. So I guess maybe you should be interviewing him and not me. No,
you know what? Let's get Thomas on the phone right now.
Yeah. We need a sub. But yeah, I'll have to say I always like consider myself a very athletic person. I mean, still to this day, I prioritize my physical health and working out and intramural sports. I love team sports. I always did as a kid. Funny enough, though, I always like did better in individual sports like running and track and field and cross country. I always performed better in school, but than like team sports necessarily, but I honestly didn't like it very much. Like, I found it kind of boring, and the one thing I liked about it was that I was good at it and people like praised me for it. Not to sound shallow, but you know, you're a kid, you're like, okay, like people think I'm good at it, but I didn't actually like it. I loved team sports so much better, even if we were losing so bad.
Yeah, no, well, it sounds like you really had the Norwegian experience, which Jack Stubbs, who was on the podcast a couple weeks ago, brought up how Norway doesn't even allow like kids to specialize in a sport until they're like 12 years old, I believe.
Yeah.
They have to like try different sports. Like, it's really encouraged by the country, and they cleaned up at the Winter Olympics. Like, they have dominated the Winter Olympics because the kids find all these, they try out all these different sports and they find like one that really works for them, or they even like get into it super late. I think there were a few Olympians that didn't even get into their chosen sport until they were in their mid-20s.
Oh, wow.
So it really shows that it's never too late to become an Olympian. But
I think my ship has sailed. I don't know if I'll be an Olympian.
You never know. You never know. So what would you say was your favorite sport growing up? But which was the one that you really enjoyed the most? I know you talked about running and cross country, but was there a team one that you really preferred?
I loved ultimate frisbee. Mm. I think that's kind of niche, but I really liked that one. I always tell people I really liked it because it's no contact. I never was like a big fan of contact sports. I'm not saying that basketball is like a contact sport. For instance, I played a lot of basketball. But it's, you know, it's certainly not non-contact, if we're being honest here. But I liked how you had your own space and you had to respect it, especially being like a shorter person, but of a smaller person. Like, it was annoying, I guess, sometimes when I played basketball. And so having that space, I think, allowed me to hone into like my actual skills of the game, instead of like worrying about my size. I always thought that was a little unfair sometimes. People got to be so much better at the sport, even though they don't actually play it, and they just, at least at the high school level, and they just kind of stand there. But it's effective. It works.
Yeah.
Like, in full transparency. So I loved that. I know I talked a lot about not loving individual sports, but I do love to ski. That was always like one of my top favorite sports. I was on my high school ski team, MVP one year, actually, funny enough.
Was that like moguls or?
No, that was just like GS and slaloms. Mm-hmm. It was, again, individual sport, but you're on a team kind of thing. I think I just liked it because I like to ski in general. I don't really see skiing as like a sport in terms of how I do it. Like, I don't see it as competitive and I'm trying to win. At least when I play ultimate frisbee and intramurals, at least there is some level of competition. But with skiing, I just like it like recreationally to do. Obviously, as you know, Adam and I go on some notorious ski trips and I bring him down some really rough hills. Adam, by the way, doesn't know how to ski or is learning how to ski.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
So we've had some fun times on the on the slopes.
You know what? I got into jumps last time. So
you
I think I'm progressing quite nicely. As I just mentioned, it's never too late to become an Olympian. So like, don't count me out yet. Only 22.
For sure. You've got some great potential.
Yes, exactly. That's probably the best way to define my my skiing career, is a lot of potential.
Definitely. Lots. So much.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you are a recent Queen's Intramural champion.
Oh my gosh, of the floor hockey team. I'm in my fifth year at Queen's, actually in politics and environmental studies. Adam and I actually met in our politics tutorial, funny enough, for the lovebirds listening out there.
I don't think there's too many.
Okay, well, just in case you're wondering. So I've played intramural hockey, or sorry, that's July. I've played intramurals in general at Queen's ever since my first year. I'm now in my fifth year and never won. And I always wanted to, and I played a bunch of different intramural sports. I did softball, ultimate frisbee, water polo, or like inner tube water polo, dodgeball. Yeah. What else? I think that's it.
Yeah.
And I've never played floor hockey or floorball or whatever it's called in my life until this past semester on the team with Adam's housemates and some of my housemates. And we won our first shirt. And I was like, oh my goodness, who would have thought? I've never picked up a stick and done that before. But going back to, I guess, what Jack Stubbs had said about, you know, Norwegian policy on sports. And I'd heard of that statistics before. But I mean, I guess that's fair to say. Like, I played a lot of sports growing up. I feel like I have decent hand-eye coordination or understanding of, like, zoning and defensive strategies, offensive strategies. Don't get me wrong. I suck at the sport. No, but no. I think I was able to pick it up decently quicker than maybe other people. And I do attribute that to maybe the many different kinds of sports I played growing up.
Yeah. I think that one of the really nice things about the Queen's Intramurals are the opportunities to play co-ed sports. Because I feel like that's something that I think maybe there was a lot more co-ed sports when I was younger and it was less serious.
Yeah.
Like, I remember like the Timbit soccer was always co-ed. And then as soon as we hit like grade 4 and up, all the school sports were separate, right? Mm-hmm. It was always there's always the boys team and the girls team, and you never really got to create like bonds with your teammates and stuff. And I always appreciated that about intramural sports, because you get to meet new people, and I think that is one of the great things about intramurals. But how would you say your experience is from playing on co-ed sports to maybe playing on an all-girls team? Would you say it's different, or is the competition level too intense? Or,
well, no, I played like high school level sports, so there mm-hmm. was a pretty high level of competition, certainly higher than intramural sports.
Right.
Like I personally don't regard those decently as high at all, but I know a lot of people do.
A lot of people do. Yes.
Namely men, I would say. Yeah. I do love like the bonds you can make with people. I think it's like at the end of the day, like it is a social activity. I think that's why it's a thing. It's a very social activity that also allows for physical activity, so it's really great for your mental health and your physical health. I think that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I hope to always do some sort of recreational sports league or something throughout most of my life. I hope to continue that out of university and into my real adulthood, because this is kind of like fake adulthood. But I will say, I think a common consensus for me, and I've vocalized this to Adam before and to my friends before, is that I'm just not a fan of overly used aggression in mm-hmm. sports, especially in a floorball, which can be a little physical. Obviously, it's intramural, so it's not nearly as physical as it probably is in other places. But typically, I would say, like, men, you know, maybe don't like losing, or maybe want to relive the glory days, especially with, you know, hockey culture in Canada. And sometimes, you know, they get into their headspace and they get a little aggressive. And like, I'm lucky to say, like, I haven't necessarily experienced too much of that personally, but I've certainly seen it throughout all of my years at Queens and playing intramural sports. And I always like to say, the thing that I say about it is, you know, I really don't like aggression in lower level sports, because I think it's overcompensating for the fact that they aren't as good as they used to be, or aren't as good as they'd like to be. And so they get mad and they're, you know, being aggressive. And so, because you could argue when you see a bit more aggression at higher levels, you're like, yeah, it's high stakes, it's competition. You know, sports are meant to have a bit of aggression, definitely, especially in hockey, where it's like they do let some fights or altercations last a bit longer than in other sports, for instance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's kind of part of the game, at least historically it was. But, you know, certainly not in intramurals, where people are, you know, sometimes even a beer deep when they're coming to these games. Yeah. And so I think it's a bit of a safety risk. I think, you know, if you're playing recreational sports, and more specifically, if you're a male playing mixed league recreational sports, I think you should take a breather sometimes and say, oh my gosh, I'm, you know, let me calm down for a second.
Yeah.
This is literally just so that I can see my friends every week and socialize and get and burn a few calories and call it a day. Like, why am I swearing at the other team mm-hmm. and pushing people to the ground and, you know, causing all this ruckus? And so, yeah. I don't know. I never found that appealing.
Yeah, no, Sam Kyle and I played in the floor hockey league before it was co-ed, so
okay.
You essentially could just field a team of all guys, and I feel like it's not to too much surprise, but the teams that always won were all guys. And the one year that we played, there was actually, I think, maybe one or two girls in the whole league.
Oh, wow.
And I noticed a complete difference in the vibes of the game when they forced it to be co-ed, and it was a lot better. I had a lot more fun going to the games and realizing that I'm not going to get my ankle slashed at all game long. I'm not going to get like body checked. Like everyone kind of like tones it down a bit. And I think that's really useful. I think it teaches you honestly skills that you don't usually get in sports, right? Like maybe a little bit more empathy for the other team. I think it keeps your emotions kind of in check too. But yeah, no, I think intramural sports are definitely a great asset to the university. Queens does a great job with them. I feel like there's so many sports to choose from.
Yeah.
We forgot to mention we did pickleball.
Do pickleball. Multi-sport athletes over here.
Had a good time doing flag football. That one gets pretty intense
technically,
sometimes.
I did play a few games of flag football.
You did.
Say.
Yeah. No, but overall, I do think that it is a great benefit to the university. Great thing to do in university. I mean, I feel like this is a really stressful time, right? It's it never really seems to interfere with exam season. So
no, yeah, I think they do that on purpose.
Yeah,
Which would be funny because I think during exam season is probably when you could use a bit more of the release. But I know they still have like lots of, you know, open gyms, open nets, or, you know, pick up some squash rackets and play squash. I know they do a good job at that, but
I don't know if we want everyone taking out their exam anger onto the intramural courts, you know what I mean?
So, no, I know. I do want to preface though by saying I'm not anti-competition. I think healthy competition is super important. If anything, I would actually describe myself as a decently competitive person. Mm-hmm. Adam could probably attest to that. Yeah. But it's just the aggression. It's like, and if you're a listener and you're saying, what do you mean? Like competition, aggression, like that's kind of a hand in hand. I encourage you to reflect on your definition of healthy competition and maybe look up and see if there's something that can exist outside of aggression.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we still won the intramural floor hockey championship last year, and it was
last semester. I guess it was last year.
It was competitive, but I don't think there were any really too many moments at all that we had to play over aggressive or lost our cool. This semester, I had a moment, but you know what? We look back on that and we reflect. Well, it was really nice to talk to you about your career, and what you're up to now. Aside from sports, you said you work out a lot and you do a lot of different kind of activities to stay healthy and moving. Is that something you've always done, or is it something you've been more recently gotten into? And what kind of value do you see in doing maybe like the more Pilates and yoga and spin? I know those are three of the main ones.
Yeah. I hate the gym. I never liked the gym. I think a lot of women would maybe agree with me, and there are a lot of women who actually disagree with me and quite like the gym, but I never liked the gym. And it's not necessarily that I didn't, you know, a lot of people or women specifically, I think, would say, oh, you know, I just never really know what I'm doing and I feel like everyone's looking at me. First of all, yes, okay, there might be like a sexist component to that for sure, but second of all, it's not that I didn't know necessarily that what I was doing. I mean, I grew up playing on sports teams, we had team workouts and all that stuff, so I had an idea of what I was doing, but it was like, it was like, you know, people are staring and it's just, I felt awkward and I never liked it. I felt like I wanted it to be more focused on like me and like peacefulness and less like, oh, like who's staring and, you know, whatever and all that stuff. And, you know, I think that it smells a little not, it doesn't smell the best. Well,
especially the
sometimes.
Queen's gym, not the best smelling gym in the world.
Yeah. And also, you know, I hate a packed gym, if anything. Like maybe if it was a really, really, really spread out gym, like hotel gyms at like 6 in the morning, you're by yourself. Absolutely. Sounds great.
Yeah.
But so I think that was part of it. It was like, okay, I'm not playing any like current sports. I mean, intramurals count, but it's like, you know, I'm not training. I'm not going to practices. I'm not working out as often as I would as I on sports teams. So I'll still do intramurals because I love sports and I love the team bonding aspect of it, but I want something more consistent to do. And so a lot of my friends, like my best friend and housemate, was a spin instructor, so she got me into spin and I really liked that. I'm big into cardio, so that was an easy transition. You know, the Pilates and yoga surge in general, which has just picked up. You know, went to a local studio here in Kingston called Moro Yoga. If you've been, you'll know it's amazing. It's like a hot room, which is really great, which is also really good for you. So I really enjoyed it. And I find it's like, again, it's not just like a physical workout, but it's quite meditative and reflective and peaceful. And I find it does more. It's good for both my mental health and my physical health. Obviously, working out at the gym can be and is good for your mental health and physical health as well. But for me personally, I feel like I get more out of it when I'm kind of in a darker room, in my own space, in a class. But that's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I think especially now, I mean, these last 2 days, I mean, you guys will be listening to this on Thursday, but as of Tuesday, it has been bright and sunny out for the last 2 days. And I haven't seen this many people out on like Tyndall Field playing spike ball. I walked past that on the way here in a while because this was a really long winter. And it's really good to have the Pilates and yoga, I think, actually played a part in maybe keeping people's spirits up during such a long winter, because it is a great way to go and kind of relax, but not relax too much, but stay fit, but still have that good mental health kind of time, I guess.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think as the summer months move on, we'll definitely see people out moving around and doing stuff. I mean, campus has never been more busy than I say today, I guess.
Yeah.
Although we're supposed to get snow this weekend, so who knows really if this warm weather's here to stay. But you're training for something too. Last time I checked, actually, we're supposed to be training for something.
That's plural. Supposed to be. Yeah.
Yes. My 1 week a night, 1 day a night floorball might not be enough. But with this nice weather coming up, I might be able to hit some runs and do some cycling now that the snow is off the ground.
Yeah.
But we are training for a very exciting trip to Mount Everest in May, where we will be doing the base camp summit.
Nepal, really exciting. It's the trip itself to Nepal is 17 days, but the trek itself, because within Nepal you have to do some internal traveling to get to the base of the mountain, the trek itself is 2 weeks long, so 14 days, so about 9 days up, I think, and the rest down. Really excited. Yeah, for those of you who might not be familiar with hiking or the specific Mount Everest Base Camp hike in general, it's actually not a very vigorous hike. The hardest thing people have said about the hike is the altitude, obviously, because it's quite high. But in terms of it being challenging or in terms of it being requiring more like mountaineering type skills, it's not that tricky. Again, I haven't done it yet, so I'll let you know. But so yeah, it's more just making sure that you have the endurance, because you're going to be like hiking with a pack on every single day for 2 weeks straight, you know, sleeping in tea houses or tents at very high altitude. So it's just training your endurance and specifically like strength and endurance together. And just, you know, ensuring that you keep your breath the whole entire time while you're doing stuff. So that's why, like, you do a lot of breath work and yoga and Pilates, which I find is really helpful for that as well.
Yeah.
So I know we're really excited.
Yeah, no, looking forward to it. And I know you guys are going to think, oh, wow, what heroes, these people going to Mount Everest.
Heroes.
But the real heroes are the Sherpas that are actually going up and down all the time. There's so many different trekking companies out there now. But I mean, I saw so many videos. I saw this one video of someone that was trying to summit and couldn't make it to the top and ended up like freezing. And a Sherpa carried him back down, like on his back. Like, there was a special backpack where they almost put like the guy that froze into like a bag. He's still alive. But, and then the Sherpa carried him down on his back. And
from
the summit.
Crazy.
I was like, oh my goodness. Like, yeah, luckily we're not going up that high. But
these guides are really great. They know a lot. They are indigenous to the mountain. My dad actually is Nepali and grew up on the mountain as a tour guide, as Adam was saying. And he's done some pretty cool things. He's never summited. Mm-hmm. I do have a bunch of family members who have, though, which is really exciting, back in Nepal. So it'd be cool to hear their stories and see how it goes. And I'm sure it'll still be great. You still get a very beautiful view of the peak from base camp, and it's still very strenuous.
Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, it's really crazy. It's really crazy stuff. And there's a lot of like not so great tourism that could take place on the mountain as well. So you really got to be careful which company you go with, make sure it's locally owned by the local tour guides and Nepalis on the mountain. But it's really fun. And if you have any, you know, if you ever want to go, I'm sure you can just reach out to this radio channel and they can give me your contact information. I don't know.
Absolutely. I'm really excited to check mountaineering off of my sport to-do list.
Yeah. Is it technically considered a sport?
Absolutely, I would say. Okay. I mean, I feel like there's competitive climbers that are out there all the time trying to do, what is it, like the 12 peaks or something, or like those, the biggest, the tallest mountains
of the world. I mean, I definitely like mountaineering or hiking in general. Like, we did a big hike in Switzerland about 2 years ago, Adam and I, or me and Adam, and I'd love to do like Machu Picchu one day. I know it's like more touristy, but you know, Kilimanjaro. But I think it's fun. I think it's cool. I like working towards something. I feel like when I'm working out, it makes me feel like, oh, I'm not just working out, but I'm working towards something, it gets me like extra motivation to like push a little harder, you know, and not just get through it. So, but the reason why we say we should be training is because Adam has not been doing as much training as I think maybe he should be or that he would like to do. What have you done so far?
It looks like we're getting really close on time, so I'm going to have to say thank you, Tara, for joining the podcast and for giving your perspective on sports, educating us all a little bit on mountaineering and Pilates. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast.